Welcome. I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations peoples right across the country. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. And welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Well, beautiful day. It's great weather for the Artie Beetson knockout down there at Redcliffe. Big mob of blackfellas down there. It's deadly. It'll be a deadly weekend. Started yesterday. Big crowd. People travelling from all over the state, and even from further afield. So that's happening out at Redcliffe. Started yesterday, goes on through Sunday. The final to be held on Sunday. That's a rugby league, the Murray Carnival rugby league knockout. So if you've got nothing to do over the weekend and you want to see some great talent in with the kids, the young teenagers. I mean, I've got my cousin's young fella come down from up Ideswell last night. He's in an under 14 side. The women are playing, and then you've got the men. It's just a magical weekend to see our mob out there, and the talent with the women, the talent with the young blokes, and even get some of the NRL players. It's not unusual to see Sam Thaido, Chrissy Sando, people like that, also getting pulled in by their home mob and running out on the field. But there is they're limited to probably two or three NRL players in a side. Otherwise, they might be stacking them and taking out the grand prize money. So if you're doing nothing, Redcliffe is the place to be this weekend. If you're a footy fan, rugby league footy, that is. My guest today, live in the studio, Jim Walker, is with CSIRO, the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research and Engagement. No, organisation. Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organisation. Jim Walker is the manager of the Office of Indigenous Engagement. Jim, welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you, Tiger, for having me.
It's great to have you in. I really appreciate your time. Tell us your mob, your country.
On mum's side, we're Yimin, and my father's side, we're Goring, from in and around Bundaberg, Gladstone area there. And so with both groups. And, it's amazing. And I've got daughters and granddaughters now. And, I know we were talking off air before about us still being around here. And it's good to see this next generation come through.
It certainly is. Well, tell us, where about you grow up and your schooling? How far did you go with schooling? And
Grew up from Rocky in Rockhampton. Went to school at Frenchville and Port Curtis. Port Curtis at that time was a little small school on the outskirts of Rockhampton that had its own horse paddock, and some of the kids used to ride their horses to school. Father's in the army, so we moved around a bit. We did some schooling in Brisbane and then in Adelaide, and then, like a lot of Aboriginal people who joined the army, we got our first chance to leave Australia, and that was to go and do a 2-year stint in Malaysia. And so went to school in Malaya and then came back here and finished school off at Kelvin Grove State High. I went to year 10 there, and so I left after that. Went and did a bit of work around the place with the Queensland Government Tourist Bureau, as it was called then. But then later in life, I decided, as I started to move into get older and then get married and have a family, thought I better go and get some education. So went back to university and got in as a mature age adult entry. And then did a Bachelor of Business there at what's now QUT. And then later in life, thought at 50, maybe I might have another crack at doing some more education after I became made redundant in the public service. So I went off and did a master's. So I thought, let's see if they can teach this old dog new tricks. And they were able to do that.
Well done.
Mm. So it's a very interesting. It was a very interesting journey over the years. Yeah, working for ADC and ATSIC, and one of my jobs in that ATSIC and ADC, I think, was looking at the establishment of an Aboriginal radio station.
This one. By gee, eh? Yeah. And there you go. And there you're sitting in one of the flashiest studios in the country.
One of the flashiest studios in the country, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Amazing. It's absolutely amazing. Yeah? Mm. And I think, you know, as they say, from little things, big things grow. Mm.
Mm.
And this is proof.
Well, that's, what would that be, 25 years or so from you looking at the paperwork?
Yeah.
25, 27 years.
Yeah, from putting that first piece of paper on that file.
Yes, through to this.
Yeah.
So it doesn't happen overnight.
No.
And we've got Ross Watson to thank for it, of course. He was the one that saw the need to have our own frequency, our own radio station, to be in control of our own communication centre type thing, you know. So,
And look at it now. I can remember listening to 4AAA and when I was living in the Territory, and I didn't know it was 4AAA at the time because when they gave the time signal, I thought to myself, geez, it's later than I thought. But it was 4AAA beamed into beautiful downtown Darwin on a Sunday.
Yeah, right.
And I think I've actually even heard it in Tasmania on relay.
Yeah, right. Yeah, they used to take it down there back in the days.
Yeah, down to Signet. Yeah, that's right.
By gee.
Yeah.
Yes, no, well, it's certainly good to have you in, Jim. How long have you been with CSIRO, as you say, the shorter term for CSIRO, CSIRO?
Yeah, with CSIRO since 2007. I came across from, I was lecturing at the University of Canberra before that, and then before that, my time at the University of Canberra, I was the coordinator for the National Indigenous Forestry Strategy within DAF, Department of Agriculture and Fisheries in Canberra. So CSIRO now been 7.5 years and certainly seen some changes within the organisation as far as Indigenous engagement, how we engage with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and what we're doing as far as, you know, looking at how we do even conduct our research with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and communities.
Mm.
It's been very interesting when you start to look back on that 7.5 years.
Mm. Mm. I've never really thought about CSIRO and Blackfellas. Because CSIRO, I've never really understood what CSIRO is, really, you know. CSIRO, like research and stuff. But it's more than that. The scientific aspect. And I said to you before we got to air, we'd be, our mob, First Nations people, would be the first scientists, the world's first scientists.
Would
that be a fair comment?
Yeah, my word. Well, let's face it, if you're starting to talk about Aboriginal people looking at science, don't forget we were one of the first peoples into physics, because look at the boomerang, look at the use of woomers and spears, and that's all around physics. There's a guy, Dr. Peter Riddell, Aboriginal, who's got his doctorate in computer science. He was saying to me, you know, like everything that we do involves physics, you know, walking, talking. So it's not something that should be, you know, we should be afraid of. It's everyday stuff, everyday things.
Yeah, so it's quite applicable to us. Like, it's quite relevant to us as First Nations people. I was just saying to you also that one of my 15-year-old twin granddaughters says to me, well, I think they both said it, Pop, we're not doing well at science. We don't like science, you know. It's a struggle, it's this and it's that. And I never really stopped and thought about it and had an answer, because I said, well, what's the relevance of it to us, Pop, you know? I don't want to go on and be a biologist or something like that, were their words, you know. But after talking with you, and I'll get you to tell us the relevance of science, and you have partly already, like the fact that First Nations people being the world's first scientist, the world's first astrologist, and so on, artists, creating art and stuff. We're the world's first.
Yes.
Very
much so, because, chemistry. You know, you look at chemistry. When we start, our use of traditional medicines and plants, that's all about chemistry. It's about genetics. It's about how we, when we start to monitor climate change, we know when when water temperatures are rising, if we see freshwater mussels open before their time, if we see trees flowering before their time, because they're the environmental indicators that, as the scientists put it, that we see that, you know, that was part of how when we knew when to go fishing for certain fish, we knew when oysters were fat.
When the eggs were out, the swan egg or swan the duck eggs or the turkey eggs.
We know that in one of our projects, you know, it's looking at an Aboriginal geohydrologist, Brad Mogridge. He was actually looking at, you know, cultural water flows within the Murray-Darling. And part of that was some of the indicators there was if a certain weed didn't come down the river, then the swans wouldn't be able to feed and therefore there would be no swan eggs. We know that if, as I say before, you know, these environmental fire management, yeah, that's all about control of the environment, and that science, Western science, is really just starting to take starting to now accept traditional knowledge all over the world as part of science, and it's amazing that we see now the use of our people. In the Northern Territory, for example, earning money out of being able to make huge amounts of money out of traditional knowledge. ConocoPhillips has a contract with Aboriginal people up in Arnhem Land for around burn-offs, and that's worth $1 million a year over, I think it's 14 years. So there are those environmental management, environmental services, but also what we contribute to genetic knowledge of plants and medicines and that genetics within them as to the active ingredients that actually help us, you know, gumby for the control of diabetes, high blood pressure and some certain cancers. So we have this knowledge. We didn't recognise it as science. We just saw it as traditional knowledge.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's out there.
Yes.
It's out there and Western science are wanting to know more.
That's right.
But it's how they engage now, I think, is the thing. We used to give our knowledge freely, more or less as informants. The scientists would come in and see us and we would tell them stories and they would take it away, write their papers, make the discovery, then pull it all apart, and then there's no mention of Aboriginal people. Nowadays, and especially within CSIRO, we've started to develop procedures and guidelines for the protection of Indigenous knowledge and intellectual property. So now... In a couple of projects that we're starting to work on, to give you an example, the Irukandji jellyfish. The Irukandji people up in northern Queensland are wanting to look at the different species of within the Irukandji jellyfish, and then perhaps use their traditional knowledge to develop antidotes to the venom. And they're working with the Australian Venom Institute, and this is a project in the making. It hasn't happened yet. And then we've working with the Umbaram people up in North Queensland who are looking at what are the genetic properties of some of their plants and seeds, and for either medicinal purposes, for that, I think they call it ethnobotanical or something like that. Anyway, as you can see, I'm not a scientist, So we're working with them to see what are the properties of those plants and seeds that they've got on their traditional country. So, and then how do you protect that? And the thing with it is that we're actually working, part of that agreement is working with an Indigenous ethnobotanist, Jerry Turpin. And Jerry Turpin was voted the Deadly Scientist of the Year last year, which CSIRO sponsored through the Deadly Awards down in Sydney. So where CSIRO is now changing, where we're actually starting to show that we value this knowledge, and we're tying in protection around and encourage them if when they do participate with us as co-researchers and collaborators, that their knowledge is protected within those projects. So which is pretty amazing because worldwide. I work on in Geneva with as part of FERA, the old FERA, And what we do there is looking at three international treaty agreements around protection of genetic resources, traditional knowledge, intellectual property and traditional cultural expressions. So it's starting to become not only recognised here in Australia, but also across the indigenous populations across the globe.
Magical. Mm. Great. And you've been with SIRA for some 7 years now.
Mm, that's right.
And you're already talking about going back to continue on with education?
Yeah, well, I'm hoping to. I've actually put together a PhD proposal. I've just got to find some time now to actually submit it. Well, it's been accepted by UQ, and what we're looking at doing now is getting the time now to sort of put the to kick it off. Mm. So I'm hoping that'll happen. 2015 will be the year.
Mm.
But
what do you plan on? What do you want to write on?
It's about governance around science, around science projects, because I believe that it's now there's a gap between where we might investigate science and we might find that Kakadu plum might be, or bush tomato might have a market, or gumby, or other such things that have a value. How do we bridge that gap between the science report and then getting funding to develop it? Because it requires a lot of infrastructure to be put in place for Aboriginal people then to get a return on that knowledge and invest in that investment. So I'm looking at where has that worked successfully. We have the Biodiversity and Economic Development Organisation in Thailand who actually bridges that gap. Indigenous Business Australia lends money for, and the Indigenous Land Corporation provides grants for the development of land, but what they don't do is research. So SIRA does the research. They provide the funds for development, but there's not this, I don't think there's that recognition of those science reports. That's good, but tell me how much is this going to cost, what it needs to develop, where's the markets? And so I'm looking at that gap. How do we start to close that gap? Inuits have got their own science commission in Alaska, and so I'm thinking, well, maybe it might be worthwhile study to talk to them as well as the group in Thailand to see how they can bridge it, how they do it well in Thailand, because they do the discovery, they do the scientific development, they do the marketing, they do the funding.
Wow.
And then outcomes for Indigenous people.
That's certainly an interesting area. Irukandji jellyfish,
mm-hmm.
some 50 years since the discovery of this fellow, and now you talk about the Irukandji people.
Yeah.
What's the connection between the jellyfish and the people, the same name? How did that come about?
Because when they discovered it, they put the name, it was the Irukandji people, name that they put with the jellyfish, because I think they were closely involved with it. Yeah, because it's on country. Young fellow up there, Gavin Singleton.
Where is your country, by the way?
It's around Cairns and north of Cairns into, and right. This project will look at monitoring the jellyfish between Cairns and Port Douglas. A young guy there, Gavin Singleton, who's another guy, young guy involved in science, he's the sort of spokesperson for the Irukandji people, and between them and the Venom Research Institute in Melbourne, and so it's interesting to see that it's been around for quite some time, and yet we're now hopefully we'll get something going there that. Mm. Can be of benefit not only to with the Irukandji people, but also with for all Australians and all visitors and tourists to those waters where the Irukandji jellyfish creates a problem.
Mm.
Mm, so
denies them access to water, beautiful beaches and swimming holes and beautiful beaches and where you want to go for a swim, but that little blue ring fella, he's the blue ring one, isn't
it? No, he's a little tiny white fella.
Oh, he's a white one. Oh, there you go. Well, there you go. All right, so the Irukandji is not the blue ring. It's a jellyfish. I'm getting, I don't know what I'm talking about when you come into the science business.
Yeah.
All right.
And I think that, we'll see a lot more of that. And what we're finding now, too, is when when as we started to increase the number of Aboriginal cadets and trainees within CSIRO. You know, these are ordinary Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who are making some really exceptional contributions to Australian science, and yet we, you know, a lot of people don't know about it. And these ones are, you know, these fellows, you know, there's they're in agriculture, they're in marine science, they're in space science, mining, biodiversity, and there are a whole range of different science, as well as in science support, in human resources, in property services. We've got one young fella in Nullumbin Murray in South Australia who's doing property services, and I thought property services is about making sure the taps don't leak, the rubbish is, you know, not taken out. But this is all about, he's got an engineering law degree, and this is all about how you protect things such as very sensitive laboratories, where, you know, it's about protecting those institutions that have, you know, very sensitive research from the large radioed space telescopes. And they're the sorts of things that involve the property service. And this young bloke, he's absolutely an amazing young man.
So there's First Nations people that are really making this, or engaging with science.
Yeah. Well, we've got here in Brisbane, we've got Kylie Smith. She's in microbiology. She's a laboratory assistant and trainee there, and you know, the people there just unbelievable the way she just took it up. No science background, has come into microbiology, and her attitude, it was a matter of attitude plus adaptability, and now she's talking the language of science. And let me tell you, I'm sure they make up some of those words. Young Natalie Halliby up at Bribie Island, you know, she's doing aquaculture. Mebu Fisher, mob from Stradbroke Island, yeah. Mebu Fisher, she's the one, you know, she's now into, she's done an internship, done a degree through CSIRO, now doing a master's. Absolutely amazing. Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Oh, it is.
It's fantastic.
It's almost time to go fishing, I think, for me.
I reckon, right? Hey, with these smart young ones coming along.
Yeah, very much so, I think. Yeah.
With a line, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, talking about laboratories, it was a CSIRO laboratory where the Wi-Fi was first discovered. By accident, you say?
Yeah, a lot of stuff that CSIRO does, you know, it's, when I say by accident, I think that it was one where, you know, they were, the scientists in question was actually looking at how to control radio waves and the like, and then came up with this the idea of remote systems, which is absolutely amazing. There's a lot of amazing people within CSIRO, and you just, you know, you just can't think of, you know, how their head works. Really, it's absolutely incredible, and that goes for some of the other ones, some of the, you know, other people within CSIRO who have looked at things such as radar, space tracking, you know, those sorts of things, and it's amazing. From anything from, you know, galaxies far beyond what we can see or even contemplate, there's this, they're tracking this satellite that was launched back in the 70s, and it's still going away from Earth.
Wow.
Yeah, so, you know, and to the oceans, you know, and robotics. I couldn't believe when we started looking at mining, and they were using machinery without people in them, yeah. And they were using a PlayStation handler. And I'm thinking, hey, that's, you get a lot of kids. If a lot of kids knew you could control these machinery, there'll be a lot more people interested in mining.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
No, it's certainly good to have you in for a yarn about this business. Particularly for our own mob, to be making science relevant, and then they're able to apply themselves. If they can understand the relevance,
yeah,
they can apply themselves.
Oh, very, very much so. And that's where I think as we're starting to get land and waterways back through either native title or, you know, even in the cases of Illawarra, you know, we're finding that CSIRO has got an Indigenous land use agreement with the Wadjuri Yamaji people over in the Murchison area, which is about 5 hours drive northeast of Geraldton. And out there we've got a square kilometre, what they call the Square Kilometre Array Project. There's about, I think it's going to be about 96 large telescopes going there, and their job will be to track the universe and find out what's out there. And that's, and we've got Aboriginal people there. We're looking how we can do business now with Aboriginal companies over there to actually do a lot of the work around maintenance, land maintenance, but also maintenance of the facilities out there. We've got two young people out there who are doing their doing studies in land management. So, and they're Wadjuri Yamaji people who will go back and who will look after country and do planning to make sure SARA has minimum disruption to their country. Mm. And so, when you think about it, you know, in order to guide CSIRO in this area too, we've now got an Indigenous Engagement Sector Advisory Council, which is one of the top advisory bodies you can have within CSIRO, and that's headed up by Professor Mick Dodson. A lot of people know Mick, and also Professor Cindy Shannon. A lot of people know Cindy from Health Days, but she's over there at UQ. Phil Duncan, Jason Field, and this is what SIRO is now looking for. How do we engage better? So that, and they're putting a lot of Indigenous expertise and for putting that in place in order to get that advice to CSIRO for the future. There's then also an implementation committee that's made up of very high senior executives within CSIRO who make sure that my office, you know, starts, you know, if we need help, we go to see them, we go to the top. And one of the champions, of course, for Indigenous engagement is Megan Clark herself, who is the CEO of CSIRO.
All right. Mm. That's great to have that sort of support at that level.
Oh, very much so. I think that, you know, we've even got an Aboriginal guy, Pari Aegis, on our Minerals Resources Advisory Council, which is...
South Australia.
Mm. And, you know, he from the old Aboriginal land rights movement, and he provides advice to all these mining executives on and our scientists who are on this Minerals Resources Advisory Council as to Indigenous strategic advice about engagement and how they're going about doing, how they could probably do it better. Mm. We've got, up until recently, I think she's still there, Mary Graham, local, and everyone around here would certainly know Mary.
Our listeners know Mary. We've got a show here every once a month. Mary's on as well. Mary's on here in the studio twice a month.
Yeah.
So our listeners know well Mary Graham. What's her role? What does she do?
Well, she's to ensure that we get our research right. Mary's a member of our Human Research Ethics Committee, so it's that committee that then anything to do with engagement or research with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people has to go through that research committee.
That committee,
yeah, and Mary's on that, and we're looking for another person to come on that mm-hmm. someone who's been involved in science, so. We're actually now starting. The culture of the organisation of CSIRO has started to change as far as how it goes about doing its Indigenous engagement, and it's pretty exciting. It's absolutely amazing that where it's come in the time that I've been there, and to see all those young ones come through in cadetships and traineeships, and some of those got jobs within CSIRO. Others have moved on. We've had one young woman to Corey One that she started off with us doing science and then has now switched over to medicine. So we're preparing them for everyone who's come into CSIRO, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people come into CSIRO, if they haven't stayed with the organisation, they've moved upwards they've got SIRO on their resume. And to say that, you know, they've got a cadetship through that or a traineeship, then they certainly enhances their employment prospects.
That's amazing. It's fantastic. Jim, you were just talking about an experience with a Murray School trainee and how you see it applying in another community, Yarrabah.
Mm.
What did you see at a young Murray School trainee doing some stuff?
Yeah, it was. We're doing a project. CSIRO is looking at. There's a potential for us to do a project with Queensland Health, and it's around developing a phone app for those people who have had cardiac events, where you know they might have had a heart attack, or there might be a potential for a heart attack. And so what we're looking at doing is developing these phone apps so people can then monitor their their health and et cetera, just using it by use of a mobile phone. One of the pilot areas we're looking at is Yarraba. Anyway, we're down there work it out at the health services down there at West End and Nutton Park there. And we were talking to this group of people, and we were invited in. And there was a young girl there who was a trainee from the Murray School, and she impressed me insofar as that you know she the way that she applied herself to actually working with the elders there. In helping them, first of all, the blood pressure, and then when they went across the road to the gym, then she made sure that they were okay. And I thought to myself, well, I said to the scientist who was with me, I said, this is what we've got to do for the Yarraba project. Because I think that what we need to do is start looking for that next generation come through. And because someone might be, 14, 15, 16, now's the time to start looking at that pathway, and it might be 10 years, but boy, geez, 10 years, as you and I both know, 10 years doesn't take long to fly. But these ones, what she did, she impressed me. I said that, this would be the sort of person that we would need who would go to the people's houses, to take their blood pressure, to maybe look at their, to take their diabetes readings for them, and to help them put it in the phone app. Because these young kids nowadays, they're all pretty phone savvy and technical savvy. So I thought, why don't we start looking at that? Why don't we start building a couple of trainees into this project if it is to happen? But the other thing is that we're looking at is also at the other end of that scale is that we may be looking for an Aboriginal PhD person who might be able to then come out and be part of that project, whereby we start to evaluate the project and investigate how it was done, because I'm particularly interested in the process of how we put it in place now, and how we communicate and engage with Aboriginal people in this health e-health area, which is good. And unfortunately, I think that it's one of those sorts of projects that it can be. It needs to have that sustainability around it, because now, as we all know, what did someone say once? That we would. There's a lot of. We should be all working for the airlines because there's so many Aboriginal pilots around the place, sort of thing. That happen, and then they just don't go anywhere. So we should be an airlines or something like that. Yeah.
Tell us the Nudgee Beach Environmental Centre.
Yeah, good project. It's part of the education CSIRO Science Education Pathway in partnership with the Queensland State Education and Nudgee Beach Environmental Education Centre, run by an Aboriginal school teacher, Phil Breslin. Phil is has been running this project now for a couple of years. It started off as a pilot, another pilot project, some years ago, and it started off about 18 kids. They came from schools around the north side. The kids actually made their own way to Nudgee Beach by train or bus, and the interest in that was pretty good, because Phil was saying how they would actually turn up at the school before he got there sometimes. It's a Cert 3 in Indigenous Land Management, and what it does is introduce the idea of science and Indigenous science. And so, in other words, it's a part of this sort of thing of joining Western science and Indigenous knowledge systems. And Phil actually teaches them in and around about what Aboriginal knowledge and how the, and where the, and how that's now becoming accepted by Western science as science. They go out to, I think they do field trips over to Stradbroke and Morton as part of it. But as he says, now you've got to do the, you've got to write up the reports. So they actually write science reports. They do it over and above what they do at school. Some of the kids, you know, they could choose, you know, to go down a different path, and some of them, you know, may not have, you know, may not be achieving the top academics, but they may not even like school. But they've taken up a real interest in this program, in school again, because of this program, because part of it is you don't do this, and he calls it deadly science. And you don't do deadly science unless you, you fulfil your requirements as far as your school goes. And this, and they go off there one, I think it's on Thursdays, to do this. So it's over and above what they do at school. It, they, when they finish, they'll come out with a Cert 3 in Indigenous Land Management. They'll come out with a Cert 2 in, I think it's Handling Agricultural Chemicals, and also a First Aid Certificate. What they do is they use GPS systems. They'll do identifications of plants, animals. They'll also look at noxious weeds. They'll also look at revegetation, and they revegetated the site over at near Nudgee Beach. And so what he's actually done is actually introduce this knowledge and a recognition of science as, hey, but my grandfather or my father or my mother or my grandmother told me something about this plant. He says, yeah, that's science. And it's that sort of recognition and say, hey, this is not as bad as I thought it was. Or this is, you know, this is chemistry, this is physics. I didn't know that. And yet that's all part of our traditional knowledge.
Yes, yes. And for them to hear that your old people are the first scientists of the world and stuff.
Yeah, and that, and that's coming from and coming from an Aboriginal teacher.
Yeah,
It's one whereby now I think there was 18 in the first cohort that went through, 15 graduated. The other three, they only missed out because of the fact their families had to move away for either work or reasons. It wasn't as though there was any dropouts.
Right.
That's now been expanded to into Logan. And now he's telling me that just the other day that they may be going out to Rosewood to look at how they might introduce this program. And what they're finding is that kids are really taking another interest, real interest in school. Literacy and numeracy rates have gone up, especially in the, and also writing, because of the need to write reports. How he delivers it, though, is the key, I think, and it's that Indigenous way of learning that he's very much akin.
That is the key.
It is.
And that is a lot of the reason for the so-called failure of our people in the education system. It's how it's being delivered. But it's about making these subjects relevant. And you just said it there, their literacy numeracy has improved as a result of their interest in this one course, one day a week. And we found that here with our training centre. We have an RTO here, and it has been in media, but now we've got to, we've expanded our scope to include business and stuff. And those kids, young people, they're not kids, they're 15, 16-year-olds, you know, young people, their self-esteem, their pride, their pride in their work, and then school, literacy, numeracy, that all, they're the signs. So it's... I'm real critical of the government's approach, federal government approach with the big stick, the punitive approach to in regards to school attendance. I mean, that is rubbish stuff, rubbish stuff. There's a far easier and a much less costly way of doing it, and it's about making school relevant.
Exactly right, and I think it's in the delivery of it. You know, it's amazing to see when see these kids that may have not been achieving academically, and their absentee rate may have or attendance rate wasn't good, but it's they've now picked that up. And let me tell you, I've actually the other pilot we did as part of that Indigenous Education Pathway was for P to 3, and it was the preschools, And I thought to myself, well, how the devil do you teach kids science? And it was things like, and I asked one of the CSIRO educators. He says, Jim, anything that explodes will get a
attention.
You get their attention. The volcano and that.
Yeah.
But what they started to do was introduce Indigenous knowledge. Things that, there was a book called "Going for Oysters," and it was about. I think it was actually written from someone up around Palm Yarrabah, and it was about, you know, when a certain tree is in a certain tree is in flower, then you know the oysters have hatched, and you know when to go, and they tell you about the how the family goes. Goes and collects them. Anyway, what we found within those Indigenous, within the Aboriginal kids there, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander kids at the preschool, was that, and it was scattered over a couple of preschools, was that these kids actually started to pay attention within the class. They actually took leadership roles within the class, and also and the parents actually then started to take an interest in what the kids are studying. And then we found that with in Phil's Phil Breslin's group as well. Parents actually became involved. Extended families turned up to the graduations of these three Indigenous land management
programs.
Fantastic. I reckon it's deadly.
Got a caller on the line. Welcome to Let's Talk. Who we got?
Oh, Tiger. It's Rod Lockwood.
Yes, Rod.
Just listen to the program, regular listener. And just listening about the CSIRO, and I have a brother who works for CSIRO, and I was just thinking that he's worked with CSIRO for over 35 years. We're from Armidale, and
you're a Koori, Koori family.
Angry and Dungari tribe.
Yeah,
so I just thought I'd give a little plug out for him while the CSIRO conversation was being talked about.
All right. He's been with CSIRO for 35 years.
Yeah, there's two of them there in Armidale with Brian Dennison. He's a Maori bloke.
Yeah.
And my brother...
what's his name, your brother?
Barry Lockwood.
Barry Lockwood. Jim...
yeah, I'm very proud of him. Yeah.
And what's his role?
Older
at the
brother.
What's his role at the moment?
He's works in the workshop. He basically runs the workshop.
Right.
He started out there as an apprentice and did all his apprenticeship there.
Yeah.
And he runs the workshop now. He's basically the only one in the workshop.
Right. Mm. Yeah. Well, Jim's not
very creative person. Very good with his hands.
Yeah. Right.
Jim's
nodding his head here. You know who he's talking about, Jim.
Yeah, I certainly do. Barry and Brian, I think they told me, scientists tell me out there at Armidale that Barry must have built at least 50% of that site, because the machinery on it, the scientists would come and say, Barry, I've got this idea. I'm just not quite sure how to go, and Barry would knock something up for them, you know, machinery and the like, for these scientists to be able to carry out their research. So, and Brian, these two guys were instrumental in getting our some of our first two trainees out there in agriculture, a young fellow called Luke and Marcus, and And every time I see Barry and Brian, they always keep talking about retirement, but they ain't going to retire. They'll never retire.
They like what they do.
Very much so. And it's actually Barry and Brian who are the role models for how we might further engage with or get more trainees and the like on, and cadets on at our site at Beswick there. But, matter of fact, when we had our first Aboriginal staff meeting, Indigenous staff meeting, there were six of us, and Barry and Brian, myself, another guy called
Greg
Davison.
Them. All right, yeah.
So they've been there for a long, long time. Barry started off as a trainee.
Yeah, and it's people like these that are needed now as mentors and support to support the young ones coming through, Jim.
Thanks for
your call, Rod. Hey, it sounds like you said you're pretty proud of your brother with his track record there.
Yeah, big brother. Yeah, very proud of him. We basically similar age, grew up together. play a lot of sports together. They're very proud of him.
Good one. Hey, thanks for that call, brother. It's good to hear from family and stuff.
A regular listener, Tiger, very good program. Yeah.
Good on you, brother. It's not much good being at the microphone if I haven't got somebody on the other end listening to me.
Oh, we listen, we listen.
Good on you. You have a good, have a great weekend, eh?
Yeah, you too. Enjoy the grand finals, wherever they may be, and the knockout up at Redcliffe.
Yes, yes, there's plenty of sport this weekend. Go the Bunnies.
Go the Bunnies. Barry's actually a big Bunny supporter.
Oh, good on him. Yeah. Okay then, brother. Good talking to you.
Okay.
Talk to you later. Bye-bye. Yeah. It's people like these guys and yourself that are needed in the mentoring and support roles, because it must be tough, Jim, for young people to come into a place like the CSIRO and not have that supportive, the wraparound services of support and mentoring and stuff.
Yeah, that's right. And that's where with CSIRO we're running we do a strategic cultural awareness program with utilising the services of Grant Sara. And again, a lot of people here in Queensland would know Grant and across the country. I think we've now got around about 900 staff at CSIRO, and that's senior executive staff that have gone through his program, and right across the country from Perth to Cairns. And I think that has been important to look at the cultural shift within CSIRO and how they might change. We've got, as a result of one of the people attending his program, a guy called John LaSalle. He's the director of Atlas of Living Australia, and he's now saying to me, how do we build, if we have this knowledge within the Atlas of Living Australia, how can we protect Indigenous knowledge? Aboriginal people are looking for a repository of how we might use certain plants.
Yes.
John LaSalle said, tell me how to, let's come in and talk about how we can protect that. How we can put gateways in there to protect it so it doesn't get exploited. And that came from one of those programs. How we, our boost in cadetships, numbers in cadetships and traineeships came from senior executives attending this program that's run by Grant, and wanting to know how better to engage, how can we employ more Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people within the organisation? And as I say, we've got people all across all areas of science. A young woman called Chantelle Lee, who's receptionist or director of first impressions within
SIRO. That's it.
And the praise that she got and her attitude within that framework, because it's changing people's minds daily about the old stereotypes that exist. I won't say the stereotypes nowadays, because the stereotypes are starting to change.
Yeah.
And she's changed it on a daily basis by just being there at the front of the office.
Just starting at the front desk.
Very much so,
But particular staff member here started the front desk almost 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And for a number of years now, she's been one of the senior officers in the accounts and payroll section here, Senior person in there, which is really good,
So it's changing that culture to make SIRO more acceptable and more ready to receive Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people within its ranks, and especially around the trainees and cadets. And now we're starting to build in mentoring, look at developing mentoring around how supervisors can mentor Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander researchers and the like. So we're looking at now building SIRO as an employer of choice of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who want to engage in science.
It's an exciting place to be.
Oh, very much so. Very much so.
Yeah.
Yeah. And hopefully, as I was saying to you before, that we might get the Murray School over, and we might show some of those young ones around again, because of that young, of the attitude and the way that young trainee.
Yep, for sure. No, we'll work on that one with you, don't you worry. Very keen.
Excellent.
We're about the end of time, Jim. You were a bit toey there through that, weren't you? For a while, a bit shaky. You got through it, no problem at all.
That's great.
Thanks for your time, Innie.
No,
really appreciate
pleasure.
It. Pleasure. And we'll be looking for a to touch base with you again in the near future.
Excellent.
You all have a great day, a great weekend, and join us Monday on your local First Nation station for Let's Talk.